Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James, what are we talking about here today?
We are talking about Mother.
Yes, the latest film from Mr. Darren Aronofsky, written and directed by Mr. Darren Aronofsky.
Who, to one degree or another, we've talked about everything he's done except Noah, right?
Yeah, I did write something about Noah when it came out that also weirdly tied into that year's WrestleMania. Go fucking figure. But it was one of my weirder things. Captain America, WrestleMania, and Darren Aronofsky's Noah. I will die on a hill for Noah. I think it's... it was made for, like, Darren Aronofsky makes movies for people like you and I, and people like you and I are exactly the type of people that will not go see a movie based on Noah's Ark, you know? Like, I was only in because it said directed by Darren Aronofsky, and it is a way darker, way more bizarre movie than anybody would anticipate, and also just seeing somebody like Darren Aronofsky have $125 million to work with is just something I will sign up for every day. But that minute of discussion of the film Noah is why we now no longer have to do a podcast on Noah and can move on to Mother, which is his most recent film.
Yes. His most recent one, very different from Noah, it would seem, in a lot of ways. But you described that as a very dark and weird movie. And that's kind of what we have on our hands again and what we tend to have when we... enter the world of Mr. Aronofsky.
Yeah, for sure. It's sort of like, I mean, there are two different worlds of Darren Aronofsky. There's the world when he has money, which is Noah and the Fountain and pretty much nothing else. And the world where he doesn't have a lot of money and he just wants to torture people through sound design and handheld camera work, which is every other one of his films. Mother is very much... more of the Aronofsky that most people know. I still think, like, a lot of people our generation would think of him as Requiem for a Dream. I would think his most famous film, though, is Black Swan.
Yeah, and The Wrestler did well and made a big splash as well, and is recent, too.
Yeah, that is true. I think, I just think of a poll, Black Swan is sort of, like, has lingered longer in the cultural consciousness sort of thing. I think it made a bigger splash. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, if we were to check the numbers, I'm sure it did. But
right.
Yeah.
And so here he is again. you know, I don't want to make it sound like all his work is redundant, though, because this is, you know, as much as this totally fits into what he does. It's not what you would have necessarily seen coming, I wouldn't think. Not you, just one film goer.
I mean...
Because it's pretty out there.
Oh, it's so out there.
Yeah.
Even before you get to the stuff that it's like, this is a movie that was released by Paramount, what is happening in the last 15 minutes? Even before you get to that stuff, it's just so... I don't know. You really have to sort of strap in for this movie as it's sort of going. And just the way that I think the way Aronofsky uses the cinematography in this movie, him and his cinematographer, Matthew Libatique, are just, I mean, it's, I was on set for the last couple of days and we were just referring to it as the Aronofsky shot, where you follow a center frame, a character, shoot it handheld and follow them as they walk. And that's rampant throughout this movie. But I feel like there's something, there's some maturity to that technique in this film that I think really adds a sort of claustrophobic element to an already very claustrophobic story. But just the way that Jennifer Lawrence's character is shown through the camera, and the fact that she is in probably 90% of the shots of this movie, like, are either over her shoulder or looking directly at her face. I think that sort of really puts you in her, I would say shoes, but she doesn't wear shoes. And I just sort of think that really builds. So when the movie gets as crazy as it does and as intense as it does, you're just so firmly in her perspective that it makes everything more horrifying. Even before things get, like, the most horrifying, it's just Ed Harris. When he shows up, you're, like, a little uncomfortable. And then when Michelle Pfeiffer shows up, it's like, what is happening? Because, you just are getting closer and closer to Jennifer Lawrence's perspective. And I think the way that the movie shows that visually throughout is very cool.
Yeah, and Aronofsky was saying that there's, with a couple of exceptions, there's three types of shots in this movie. It's that close-up, which is, as you said, most often of Jennifer Lawrence. Over the shoulder, again, very often of hers, and a POV shot. And, you know, that's the ultimate put you in someone's shoes kind of shot, right? So there are some very important and memorable shots that aren't of that, but so much of it is those three shots, either of her or from her eyeballs.
Exactly. And it is really, really impressive how firmly they stuck to that idea, because like you said, there are exceptions, but they are very few. It's basically after the birth of the child towards the end, there's a lot of sort of standard wide shots of her and Javier Bardem sitting in the room together, in a much more traditional sort of style of wide shot. And a lot of the there's a lot of framing from outside of the room that Ed Harris stays in when Jennifer Lawrence is actually physically inside the room, which I don't have a reading of, but pretty much every time she's in that room, we see a shot from like outside looking in on her in that room. And also just the Javier Bardem stuff at the beginning and end is more not from her perspective, because she no longer has a perspective.
Yeah. And there's a couple eagle eye shots of the house.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Her sitting on the stairs reading the poem, I believe, or reading the latest piece.
Yeah.
That's one that jumps out because that's a hot shot.
Yeah, but just talking about how you kind of briefly mentioned how well they stick to that that aesthetic of these very limited shots with only a few exceptions. And you may have read the same interview, but him talking about how much they had to edit for this movie because you don't have those wide shots to go back to establish the geography and the setting and the position of everybody in this in the room or in the scene. And that was one of the difficulties, is since they never had those shots of coverage to cut back to between close-ups. And that this sounds like an exaggeration of the kind of thing like Darren Aronofsky would say, but that there's more visual effects in this than there is in Noah, just because they have to speed things up or slow them down or you know, change an angle slightly or erase a boom mic or something from the shot. Just the way that they shot this was you know, not a ton of money, not a big crew, and these restrictions that they put on themselves visually, that making this a, let's say, watchable movie, if you feel that way about it, was quite the hassle in the editing bay.
Yeah, and so just to explain from sort of the perspective of an editor, what makes insert shots so helpful is, and the reason why you shoot them is, so generally the process is, like, let's say we were shooting a basic conversation, we would shoot the wide shot conversation with Javier Bardem and Jennifer Lawrence. I mean, that's a terrible example because none of their conversations are shot this way in this movie, but like, say it's another movie shot by a hack director, and they're just sitting across from each other in a chair. You shoot the whole thing in a wide shot, you get an over the shoulder of each person, so you get a close-up of Bardem doing his lines, close-up of Jennifer Lawrence doing her lines, and then say Jennifer Lawrence picks something up off the table, you would shoot an insert of that, right? And so when you cut to that insert, you can then switch from take to take. If you want to stick in the close-up from one line to another, you put the insert shot in the middle, you can use the close-up from the take one close-up and then skip to take four close-up after that insert, right? And there's just a lot of little things that you can cover up simply by having inserts. And so by not having inserts, not only does it keep us in Jennifer Lawrence's perspective in a more consistent way, it just also makes things way, way harder in the editing booth, you know, as you explained. But just try to add a more detail to it, I suppose.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, it's just like building anything, but only having, you know, three different pieces to build, like a building out of, right? You've got to really shape those pieces and do a lot of extra work with them to make it like a structure that we're used to seeing that can stand up with any integrity.
Exactly. And like, I saw this picture on Twitter a couple of days ago of a Super Mario poster, a puzzle, jigsaw puzzle, but like 50% of the area was just a flat red. and like the caption was, "I'm done with puzzles," and like, and that's what they're doing. They're putting together this 50% space just with red pieces, and it takes you a long time to figure that out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and just, I mean, to think of that more broadly of what they are putting together here, you know, we've kind of given a few points in this movie where things change. You know, you kind of said those last 10 or 15 minutes, there's a huge transition. When I have a hard time talking about this movie just because it is dream logic. You know, this is such a physical impossibility of what takes place here. It's such a logistical possibility. It's a physical impossibility. Like, we kind of have to throw a lot of normal narrative beliefs out the window with this movie.
Yes.
So that will be me tripping over my words slightly as I try to use English to describe this craziness. But off the start, we kind of get, you know, we did a podcast on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And for a while, it feels like this is a, you know, one of those like manners comedy or, you know, really heavy dramedy, I guess, of, you know, this hostess who's being so imposed on. You know, there's a couple lighter moments in this movie, and most of them are at Jennifer Lawrence's character's expense. I guess we can call her mother because that's how she's credited. But as Ed Harris, or as Michelle Pfeiffer, as the kids come to impose on her, I mean, by the time the kids are there, it's things are pretty out of hand or about to be out of hand very quickly. Yeah, but it does kind of play off like this domestic sort of comedy and, you know, like how to be the worst house guest ever sketch for a little bit. But even when we're in that moment of the film, there's still so much darkness and weirdness to it. Like, it, even when it's this one thing before it changes to the other thing, there still is this awful atmosphere kind of weaved in and out of the dialogue and through the visuals. Does that make sense?
100%. And I would agree with that. Just if the movie started with just Javier Bardem and Jennifer Lawrence like eating breakfast and then continued on till Ed Harris shows up. But like, the movie also sort of opens with a shot of a woman surrounded by flames staring in the camera, and then we get the title card, and then you get the transition to the Javier Bardem intro. So like, and nobody really knows what the hell is happening. Jennifer Lawrence like rises up out of this stop motion bed thing and just says baby, and then wakes up and goes downstairs. And so yeah, the movie starts from a very strong dream logic place, but so I think that augments what you're describing. But I think what you are describing also would have like just felt real, or you know, you would have been able to feel it in the audience anyway, even without those really magical moments at the beginning.
Yeah, and just the unexplained magic yellow powder she drinks and the heartbeats she kind of feels within the house. Even when this movie is doing its version of playing it straight, it never like it never lets you kind of feel relaxed at all.
Yeah, Aronofsky's not big on relaxation.
No, he's not.
Yeah, if you want to have a go to the beach and have like a cool breezy film festival, don't watch any Aronofsky movies.
Yeah, it's true.
Those classic beach film festivals.
So how did you feel about that? I mean, glossing over the initial creepier image that you're just describing. I mean, to look at this in sections, how do you feel about kind of what we're seeing up until, let's say, the kids show up?
You just sort of feel uncomfortable. And especially once, like, also as somebody that doesn't like strangers in general, like, I just sort of...
Or people in general.
Well, people in general. And or smoking near me, you know, all these things. I mean, it was a real contradiction having Ed Harris be that person, because I was like, oh, Ed, I like you so much, but like, I don't like what's happening. And also just, I always find a partner obviously not understanding their partner's needs and desires, like very that sort of always hits me, like the just that sort of disconnect, and that disconnect drives that part of the movie, you know. So that just naturally makes me uncomfortable. These are just things that make me uncomfortable. So I would say, like, in the way that I can enjoy anything in this movie, because I really enjoyed this movie, but like I enjoyed it specifically because of how uncomfortable it made me. So I really enjoyed that part, and things just get basically, like, with each additional person that shows up to the house, things get ratcheted up, and Michelle Pfeiffer is the next person to show up, and from that point you really get an even more heightened sort of version of what was happening before, because Ed Harris at least, like, tries to pretend like he cares about the well-being of others, whereas as soon as Michelle Pfeiffer gets there, she's just like, no, this is my house now, you know.
Yeah, and I would say that Ed Harris at least does her the favor of kind of, like, I know what you mean, that he does kind of pretend to be a good guest and be somewhat appreciative of them, where we don't get that so much with Michelle Pfeiffer, but he at least at times has the decency to just, like, ignore her instead of being outwardly awful towards her the way that his wife soon is when she spends any time with them. Like, I get the sense that Ed Harris, his character, is such a fan of this poet, mm-hmm. that he kind of overlooks this woman, which is rude and, you know, not to be done in anyone's home who's being nice enough to let you into it, but is not, you know, prying or saying these awful things about her and being very presumptuous and kind of making her feel guilty for any number of things. Like, at least his sins are something of sins of omission, where her sins are commission. Like, she is outwardly doing awful things, not just overlooking her.
Yeah, absolutely. And and also Michelle Pfeiffer's awesome in this movie. I think Ed Harris too. Especially,
yeah, Michelle Pfeiffer's really good.
She has the most fun character to play, I think. But man, 100%. she is good in this movie. And Ed Harris is fantastic as well. Like, find me a movie where he's not. But when he lights up his smoke after coming at the door, she says, "Oh, we don't smoke. Oh, that's good for you," or whatever he says. It's so funny. But I don't know. There's just something, like, and also, since you think of Ed Harris as, like, an angry guy when you sort of picture Ed Harris, but you don't think of him as, like, this dick, you know?
Yeah, and like, gregariously dickish.
Yeah, to call him playing against type in this movie is too far, but it definitely sort of breaks a little bit from the Ed Harris that we assume we're going to see.
Yeah, the super intense one.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, I mean, he vomits intensely in this, but... that's pretty much it.
Yeah, for sure. And basically things get ratcheted up, and there's three sequences in this movie that really are the big ones. There's the Cain and Abel scene, where Donal Gleason murders his brother, who is actually his real life brother.
It is.
Yeah, okay. I thought I was right about that. I wasn't sure. But and then there's the funeral scene, which is another I think might be the scene that makes me the most uncomfortable in the whole movie, because it's not so ludicrous. Like, what happens in the third sequence is just so crazy. Whereas this one, it actually resembles an event that I've felt. Like, it feels like being at a party that you don't want to be at, and that you're also hosting the party, which is something that I have felt. And, like, you can really get this feeling of people not respecting your space. And I think the movie translates that really well. And that,
yeah, with the funeral stuff, like, maybe it's weird how quickly some people show up. You know, just different groups of people showing up, usually there'd be a larger, you know, number of minutes in between them all, mm-hmm. but there's nothing really that you have to suspend your disbelief that they do while they're there. Like, conceivably there are people who are this rude,
whereas
by the time, you know, we kick things up one more time,
I all think 40 more times,
but... well, yeah, if we're splitting this movie into thirds,
Yeah, and just that house party, like, the kicking people out of your bedroom and them just being, like, incredulous about it. Like, it's just so, I don't know, that in the sink. And, I mean, also the guy talking to mother, like, all of these things are just pretty, like, real things that could happen it's like it's like every party scene in a teen movie, but it's not played for laughs anymore. And since the movie puts you so firmly in mother's perspective, like you can just feel it all, and it just feels so insulting and keeps building. And yeah. Just makes you really uncomfortable.
Yeah, they quickly get past throwing around Lindsay Lohan's vase in her kitchen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I really truly did not know what I was getting into with this movie, and I think someone could have given me a heads up, and I still wouldn't really know what I was getting into with this movie.
I can't even imagine what sort of heads up you can give that would sort of give an indication other than saying a baby gets murdered and mutilated in this movie, you know, like
eaten.
Yeah, exactly. Like that is the description you would have to give, and that's in like the last 10 minutes of the movie, you know.
Yeah, but I was thinking, like, when it's just even before the kids show up, which is when things get violent and get really violent for the first time, so you know this is something else. I remember
that scene escalates so quickly too.
Yeah,
so
it does. And is really effective in that way, because that's not unbelievable. Like it's very intense and incredible. And I've never had anything like that happen in front of me, but it's, you know, believable. I just remember thinking just when Michelle Pfeiffer is being awful and Ed Harris was being a slightly less form of awful, are they gonna take their foot off the gas in this movie a little bit? Like, this is getting a little much.
Yeah.
No, they don't. They park the car on a rocket ship, and then that's what happens.
That's a pretty good description.
But yeah.
Yeah. And it really is, like, just to talk about the Cain and Abel scene just a little bit, like the setup for that scene with Jennifer Lawrence, like, placing that doorknob that Javier Bardem has broken off, just the setup, and, like, the fact, like, we don't see that Donald Gleason grab that door handle for more than, like, 10 frames on screen, like, because we're so, like, it's a POV shot from Mother as she's following him, and he just grabs it so quickly and just keeps moving, and the camera's so shaky there, but you can also tell what's happening. And I just thought that was like a really impressive sequence done in a style that is noted for making it hard to tell what's happening. And it was like, it was very greengrassy in the way that I never felt like I lost track of. And when I mean greengrassy, I mean Paul Greengrass, the director of Bourne Ultimatum and Bourne Supremacy and Jason Bourne and United 93 and a handful of other great movies. In just that it was so handheld, but you also had things to grab onto visually, and you could see the story being told despite the fact that they were purposely like shaking the camera to make it more intense. And I thought that was really well done.
Yeah, it's not the most intense, just because if you write down everything that happens in this movie, that's not it. But yeah.
There's a SWAT team throwing fire at human beings later on in the movie or something.
Yeah, but I think as far as filmmaking, I think that's one of my like the tightest sequences that I think was the most effective. And maybe because things aren't ludicrous yet, like they are, as I said, extremely intense and violent and unbelievable and quick for, you know, like you can't quite catch up with what's happening. But I think it's done very, very well.
Yeah, and all of the and also just the distribution of time in these I guess we can just call them the action sequences of the movie. Like the Cain and Abel scene is very short comparatively to the funeral that comes next, and the funeral is very short compared to what comes after that. And also in between all of those are like extended periods of downtime, and especially from basically, you know, until Javier Bardem and Mother get away to go give birth, so Mother can go give birth. Once she's giving birth, there's a long period of time, or at least it feels that way, whether or not the real time, it might actually only be like 3 to 5 minutes. But since we see the same shot repeated over and over again in a way that we haven't seen without movement throughout the movie, it feels like a long period of time. And you just sort of get to breathe a little bit before things get ratcheted up to their final level. I just think that like the pacing of the movie is almost feels a little weird, but in a way that I think makes everything that's supposed to feel more intense feel way more intense.
Yeah, and I think that's what I was trying to get at when I was talking about you know, the first time the brothers come in after we've been with Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer for a lot, just thinking like they have to let their foot off the gas. Like there's just no way a movie can continue at that pace. And I know for large sections of this movie that does continue at that pace, but I just felt like things were going to have to breathe again sometime soon. Mm-hmm. And I was wrong. They do breathe eventually, but you know, things get ratcheted up before that. It's reminded me of when people used to talk about Mad Max. They're like, it's one big car chase scene. And you're like, it is, but it's also not. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, there's times where you're not seeing a single vehicle move. You know they're being hunted. But just, like, the human heart and mind, I don't think, can deal with that level of, like, upward trajectory of intensity for 90 to 120 minutes. So, I knew that we were going to get a bit of relief, but I didn't think that there would be nothing before that brother sequences.
Yeah.
And so we do get moments of downtime, and I think the birth one is one of the ones that feels so cathartic in a way, because you know you've seen mother, and she's a mother before she's a mother in this movie. You see her get bumped around, and you see this level of physical contact that you just like, that just makes you shudder when you know someone is pregnant, let alone extremely pregnant, right? And even if she wasn't pregnant, she shouldn't be having to deal with that level of physical contact either. Mm-hmm. But you know, it just makes it that much worse.
And like, yeah, and just to give you a specific example, when she hits the ground when she's pregnant, like, I've seen this movie two times, both times multiple people have gasped, you know?
Yeah, she lands, like, on her stomach. Like,
yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not just tripping over something, falling backwards. Yeah, so that's, you know, we've just been so so tense for this long. And then, as you said, they kind of repeat a few shots. You get this moment of catharsis. You get these calm, peaceful scenes. Like, even you know there's 100 people behind this, well, more than 100 people behind this door, but they're quiet, you know. There's kind of soft light coming in. It's just this pleasant moment inside the bedroom, and it's really the only space that they have. And this movie is so much about domestic spaces being violated, yet they still have this one refuge of, you know, the bedroom they share together still being one place of privacy for them.
Isn't it, it's his office that she gives birth to?
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
And like notable also because he, you know, he boards it up earlier.
Right. Yeah. But just the idea that they still have this any kind of personal space when the geography of this movie has just been so violated by unnamed, unknown outsiders.
Yeah, exactly. Like that guy from The Leftovers and that guy from True Detective Season 2 and Kristen Wiig.
Most notably Kristen Wiig.
Yeah. Such a mistake casting her there.
Oh, you think so?
Too small of a part, too late in the movie. Like, the guy from True Detective, True Detective 2, like, one of Vince Vaughn's lackeys in True Detective 2 is used very well in this movie. And, like, he comes into the movie late, and he's not famous enough to make it weird, you know? Whereas, like, again, both times I've seen this movie, you can hear people be like, is that Kristen Wiig? It's like the Matt Damon in Interstellar. Like, it's just sort of like it takes you out of the movie, regardless of whether or not like having her in the role is fantastic. It's just like it's almost too late, you know? It's just like it takes, especially since it's coming in the middle of a pretty intense sequence, or to the beginning of a pretty intense sequence, but enough that it sort of takes takes your mind off of the movie a little bit and puts you back into real life for half a second. I don't know, just something about that is a mistake to me.
Yeah, okay.
I in no way think her performance is bad. I think it's a directorial mistake.
Yeah, and even if you introduce her a few minutes before and then let things get escalated once she's been established already, when you're not trying to like grasp so hard to understand what's going on.
Yeah, and just that it's like I don't know, it's hard, you know, like that it's an hour and 20 minutes into the movie and then just somebody who's slightly famous enough that most people recognize her. I don't know. It's just she's too famous to pop up in this movie. I don't know. It's hard to explain, but it just felt wrong. You know?
It's one of the skeleton twins.
That movie was terrible. Bill Hader was fantastic, though. And great Luke Wilson in that movie. Anyway, continue.
You know, how were your crowds for this, like, reaction-wise?
One was a Saturday 10:30 a.m. crowd, so like that's not a real... that's in no way to gauge a movie. Again, I mean, I told you this on the weekend, but it was a Saturday 10:30 a.m. screening, which is usually populated by people 40 to 60 years older than me. And I suspect that most of the people in that theater chose the movie exclusively because the title was Mother, and they had no idea what the movie was or who Darren Aronofsky was. So that was sort of just a weird vibe. But I saw it with a full crowd at night, and it was people were laughing at shit, which was weird. I think there were some people that were fully locked in, and some people that expected more of a like It sort of style horror movie. But also some really good reactions, like gasps and a couple screams, and not like full on blood curdling Jennifer Lawrence at the end of Mother screams, but like audible noises that can't quite be described as screams, but are at least adjacent to scream.
Right. Yeah. I didn't see it in a very crowded theater.
Sounds like the most people's experience, but continue.
Yeah, right. The most notable thing was there was just some laugh. I don't know if this was how did this get made, or I have no idea what to do with what just happened to me. There was just a bit of laughing right when the credits started that I kind of sensed going to happen.
Yeah, for
like,
sure.
Yeah, just... It's a lot, man. I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but it's a lot to deal with.
It really is. And I mean, we haven't really talked about your opinions of the movie. Like, how do you feel about it?
I think it was super unpleasant. I don't. And I mean, you know me, and maybe anybody who listens to these knows that I'm not often it's usually not too heavy for me. This was a lot to deal with, though. Yeah, it was just kind of unrelenting, and it's one that thinking about and reading about and, hypothesizing about intent has been a lot of fun, but I didn't enjoy being there.
Okay. Can you compare that to the experience of watching other Aronofsky movies? Like, how does that compare to how you felt about Black Swan? Regardless of feeling about the quality of Black Swan, which we've discussed in the past, but just sort of the experience of watching that movie.
Yeah, I think that there is just more... it's been a while since Black Swan for me, too. But I don't know. I just think that it was just there's just more nuance to it. And but I've had more fun thinking about this than I've had fun thinking about Black Swan. But yes. Any given moment of Black Swan is less horrible than almost any given moment of this.
Fair enough. Some of the
that's not a walk in the park movie either.
Some of the toe sound effects are really difficult for me to get through in Black Swan.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and as I said, I think that the Ed Harris, Michelle Pfeiffer stuff was tough in a certain way, but not insufferable. Yeah. And then I think that the brother sequence, as short as it was good. And I know my boy Gleason's not going to be hurting for work for the rest of his lifetime, but it's still always good to see him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think some of the filmmaking in the last bit is really good. And just the degree of difficulty to pull off what they pulled off with some of the restrictions that they largely just put on themselves, I think, is very impressive. Mm-hmm. And... always like me some Javier. And I think Jennifer Lawrence kind of has a bit of a thankless job in this. Because I think she's supposed to be really like, if she's, you know, she's the protagonist, right? She's the one that we see the most of by far. She's the title character.
She's the reason this movie was able to get made.
She's the reason this movie was able to get made from a more production standpoint, for sure. And I think to be the protagonist and to be acted upon the whole time, like not acting in a thespian sense, but to be this reactive, kind of passive thing that the movie happens to, you don't lead this movie, I think is a tough role. And I don't think she does a bad job of it. And I just think that's a hard thing to not let the movie kind of just fold you up into itself. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, I understand what you're saying, and I think that's correct.
Yeah. And so that's, I mean, good for her on that.
Also, just such an emotionally difficult headspace to be in for, I don't know, 2 months or a month and a half, however long they were shooting this.
Yeah,
and not to mention the many
50
weeks.
Days, yeah.
Sorry?
I think they said 50 days and like 3 months before rehearsing.
Yeah, exactly. It was an extensively rehearsed movie, which almost never happens anymore.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to run a quote past you. Maybe you've seen it. David Edelstein, A Vulture.
I've been so busy. Okay. I've done almost no research.
Great. That's fine. Cause I'm going to hit you some research right now. So it's just a few lines. He starts with his assessment of The Fountain, which, you guys will disagree over, but it's brief. So yeah, David Edelstein of The Vulture says, except for his loopy swoon song, The Fountain, Aronofsky has hit all his marks, achieving everything he has set out to do, which is no small feat. But once he has his premises, he doesn't develop them, either because he doesn't know that's required or he thinks that it would hobble his transcendentalist objectives. His entire dramatic strategy is escalation. A character who begins mildly delirious will become rather delirious, utterly delirious, ultra delirious, and then burst into flames. The end is like the beginning, only much, much more so. How's that for an assessment of what Aronofsky does?
Bang on.
And do you think that... Okay, and now this seems to be, from that and just from reading the entire article... This is more pejorative than I think your assessment of Aronofsky is. How do you balance those two?
So, I've been shooting a lot recently and like with a pretty sizable crew. And so my research has basically been talking to everybody on the crew about how they feel about Darren Aronofsky and anybody that's seen Mother we talked about. And one of the conversations I had with somebody was that we were just talking about how he doesn't, I don't know, he's not like an Aronofsky guy. And I would say like... I don't rank these directors. They're all sort of just wonderful, wonderful voices that I will rush out to see. I think Darren Aronofsky would have to go a long time between making movies before I was like, hey, why hasn't Darren Aronofsky made anything for a while? You know, he's not in that like Soderbergh Fincher sort of world for my brain. But like, I think every time he makes a movie, I'm excited to see it because what he does is sort of make David Lynch sorts of movies, but he sort of pours them through this like filter, this Michael Bay sort of bombastic filter, and it's still this like art house cred sort of bombast, but it is sort of David Lynch through and like cranking it up to 11 sort of thing. Aronofsky's so big on sound design, like I think sound design carries his movies so frequently, and that's I feel the exact same thing, same way with Lynch. And Aronofsky just seems to hate a static camera, exception of course being The Fountain, which has a lot more static camera work than usual. And he just escalates. And I think that describes Michael Bay as well, you know. And it's just sort of, I think he really straddles this line between art house and sort of genre action / horror. And I think just the certain things that he chooses to focus on helps him make really unpleasant movies and really escalating movies, but in a way that I enjoy watching, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I just, reading that one, I think kind of hit on some of the things that bugged me about this one, because I think for a movie that is so, you know, I said I didn't know what I was getting into, it's so off the wall, it does so many things, I still felt like I was on this straight trajectory. Like I just things that were so that did seem so crazy just didn't seem out of left field, because it just seemed like it was on this straight path, and that straight path was going very intense, wild places, but there was just kind of no deviation that renewed my interest throughout. You know, as I said, I appreciate a lot of the things about the filmmaking of it, but I think I just needed, it's weird to say this about a movie that does such odd things like, you know, cannibalize a baby partway through, but I felt like I just needed something a bit more unexpected than these extended sequences of of chaos. And then I think after the fact, you can look into it, and there's, you know, a million different readings of this that I think are all mostly valid, but none of them entirely valid, because I do think the work kind of eats itself by trying to do so many different things and have it kind of every way. But there's just something that's too linear, despite the extreme nature of it.
Yeah, I get that. And just to calm my own thinking about the movie, like, I was really dedicated to, you know, even more than usual, for when we're doing this podcast, I really wanted to make sure I could see this movie two times before we talked about it, because I had a suspicion that I would get almost nothing out of a second viewing, and that proved to be basically true. I just paid more attention to the cinematography, but as far as my thematic reading of the movie, it was unchanged by the second viewing, and I think that is sort of a world that Darren Aronofsky, sorry, I almost called him David Lynch. got Twin Peaks on the brain still. That's the world that Darren Aronofsky lives in. Whereas I think he a lot of times he makes movies that are really point A to point B and just are really unpleasant, but unpleasant in a very, in still a very engaging, entertaining way. And there are very few movies of his that I come back to. I mean, it's not like I rewatch The Fountain every year even, and that's the one that would be his time capsule movie for me. It's just, he's just so talented that I am excited to watch his movies, but I also go into them realizing that there's never going to be a point where the fifth viewing of a Darren Aronofsky movie is my favorite, you know? Again, the exception being The Fountain. But I am alone on that one. Me, Noah, and the Fountain are alone on a hill together.
What a fun hill that sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at least by comparison to Aronofsky's other films. But yeah, that's sort of where I'm at on it.
Yeah. Do you think that you are surprised by how this is being received, or have you just been out of touch with it? Or
I would say, okay, so I also, it didn't have its world premiere at TIFF, but it did its North American premiere at TIFF, and
it's Venice, right?
Yeah, Venice is the world premiere, and I just, knowing the guy that was shooting the premiere there, I was talking to him that night, like literally after having seen the movie, and he walked into the office where we've stashed all our gear, and I like saw his face, and he looks like everybody in the theater who had just seen Mother, you know, like there's just, you gotta like sort of come down from it a little bit. And I didn't want to know anything about it because I didn't get a chance to see it till all those regular people did. But he was talking about just the I asked a little bit about the mood of the theater, and it was just like, I don't know, just the way he described it, it was just a theater of 1,300 people watching Mother, you know, like, yeah. And that just sounded like something I would have loved to be a part of. But, and that's the vibe that I've gotten from other people. And again, talking to people this week, whenever I had the chance, people that I know that have seen it, I've been asking them about it. And, I think that the consistent review of it, I suppose, has been people saying something along the lines of, I wasn't crazy about it, but I will say I have been thinking about it a lot. And I think that really, I love that, you know, like whether or not people remember this movie as like a good movie, I do, as somebody that loves engaging my own thoughts about films and loves having people to talk about films with, anything that at least engages your brain, I think is good. Whether or not you actually enjoy it is cool, is almost second, you know, on the list of importance to me, you know?
Yeah. What do you think of this, the chances of this like sliding over into kind of like camp kitsch territory?
Like over time or like now?
Yeah, over time.
I think it's too horrifying. I can't see it coming into camp. I don't know. It just seems so, it's just so physically unrelenting, like the camera, the framing. I just can't think of a camp movie that's shot this way. You know, it's just too, I want to say in your face, but too in Jennifer Lawrence's face. Like you're just so in her place in this movie, in her shoes. And I don't know. I just can't see it changing that way, going that way.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think that, you know, to call it too gory or to call it too violent, like, that's something that works so well to get into camp, right? If they overdo it, and, you know, so many of these camp movies can be that there's just so much blood or there's so much, right?
Yeah.
But I think I'm with you, because I've kind of seen it be bandied about that it might do that. It might already be there. But I think that for all my criticisms of this movie, I think that it's too well made that even watching this and wanting to, like, joke around about it, like, the filmmaking's just, it's done by too many talented people, and the acting's too good and the filmmaking's too good that as time passes, you know, there will be some distance from it and it won't be as difficult for people to get their heads around. But I just can't see, like, you and not you, but like a person and four of their drunk friends being like, you know, it'd be a funny movie to watch, right? Like, it's just,
oh,
it's
my
just,
God.
It's just too much. Like, it's just, it's too immersive. And yeah, I have bad things to say about it too, but it being affecting is not one of them.
Yeah. So, okay. So another movie I was recently talking about was Showgirls, right? Like, one of these camp classics. And
yeah.
Have you ever seen Showgirls?
I never have seen Showgirls.
Okay. So it is so fun and so entertaining to watch for the first 90 minutes. It is a full 2 hours. The first 90 minutes is as advertised. It is so stupid and so funny. And the sex scene with Kyle MacLachlan in a hot tub is hysterical. But the movie takes a super dark turn towards the end. And it's shot in a really realistic way. And it absolutely, like, stops any fun you were having. Like, it's just too... there's no way that you can have fun afterwards. And
yeah.
Mother is all that. It's all the last third or the last quarter of Showgirls, you know? And there's just no way it can be a camp movie, you know? It's just too much.
Yeah, no, and I get that same sense. And I think that there's... even though I was saying that this is also a really well-done part of the movie, I think that there's a way that, like, just because Michelle Pfeiffer's so over the top and, like, she's great, but as you said, like, it's such a juicy role. Like, there's just so much there that, you know, I think there could be that distance to get to camp with some of that stuff, but there's just too much there's too much of the rest of it that is, as I said, just too affecting.
Okay. So let's talk about, like, a reading of the movie. And I will say this, one of the few things I have read Darren Aronofsky say about this movie is that, I think he sort of views it as something that is more, more just something that he wanted to make to sort of get out of the system. I feel like he doesn't think it's his best work, which is interesting to hear him say so early on in its release. I mean, also I'm inferring on his words, but I don't remember the exact quote, but something along the lines of what he said is that he doesn't want people to think too hard about it. He just sort of wants it to be sort of, I mean, it's a horrifying ride, but a sort of ride. But I'm curious to know your reading of the movie, like the meaning of the movie.
Yeah.
Because he's too intelligent to not try and put something like that in it.
Right. And so I think he said it uses dream logic. He said, if you try to unscrew it, it kind of falls apart, is a quote. It's a psychological freak out. You shouldn't overexplain it.
These are the exact quotes that I
heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, well, and he's very open about the notion that this is a global warming or a, you know, an environmentalist movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of his passion outside of making film is awareness and whatever he can do about that. And
Noah was a lot of that too.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's there. And if he says that's what it's about, you know, that's what it's about. But yeah. I think that this is a lot of different things at once. And I think when he says, you know, if you unscrew it, it kind of falls apart, is that there is, I think, 10 different readings that work for 85% of this movie.
Okay.
And if you try to do one of them, there'll be some things that just don't make sense, that work for a different reading of it, but don't work for this one. And the one that I couldn't help but notice, and this isn't too deep of a reading because in a way it is the most, the basic reading, is sharing your life with a creative person. And I think that he's been a director for a long time, a pretty successful one. And I was, you know, he's been married, and I assume he's had a ton of relationships with other artistic people, romantic and otherwise. And that was the one that I couldn't get away from, and that I've, you know, in researching it after the fact, is one that a lot of people put a lot of water into. And, you know, that's really not even subtext. This movie is about someone, you know, if we're going to say Jennifer Lawrence is who we're supposed to relate to, this movie is about our protagonist living and dealing with the life of a creative person and the imposition of fans and, you know, his craft and everything that, you know, works the way into the house that makes it difficult to do what she wants to do, which is make a home in a variety of ways. It makes it very difficult for her. And I think that's it's definitely the one that I thought about the most while watching it. You know, there's a biblical one. There's a lot of gender stuff in here, which I don't think is entirely separate from most readings of this. You know, that's just an important part of a lot of different readings of a lot of different movies, but this especially. And that to me is the one that makes the most sense. I've heard him offer up that this is political. Again, the biblical one is big, and a quote he has about the endless buzzing of notifications on our smartphones and his experiences in Hurricane Sandy. And I see elements of that throughout this, but it's what it is to spend your time with someone who spends so much time worrying about what other people think of his art is the one that I think is going to stick for me. What do you think?
Yeah, for sure. And I never thought about the sort of global warming and we have to treat the planet better, despite all that I do know about Darren Aronofsky, because despite, you know, what I said previously, like, if, you know, there's some sort of, the playlist has this interview with Darren Aronofsky, I'm reading it 100 times out of 100, just because I just find him an interesting thinker, and he talks about film in an interesting way. But and also Noah was so prominently about that, so I probably should have seen that coming, but I had the same reading as you. But once you do read Darren Aronofsky's description of it, which I think he is talking about so much because he wants to get away from the artist reading, because the artist reading is so dark, like it paints him in such a dark light.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, he is like, I'm blanking on his last name for whatever reason now, but the guy in Black Swan, the ballet teacher, like Aronofsky has this history of these creative men who
are older and predatory.
Older, predatory specifically towards women. And I don't know, it's just so weird. It's just odd. And
because it has to be him, right?
Exactly. Like, that would be what any person who has ever thought about film in any capacity. Like, that's a first week of film class sort of thing, is that a director is putting themselves into this movie. Who is the person in Black Swan that is most like a director? Oh, it's the ballet director, you know? Like,
yeah.
And same with a movie written by Darren Aronofsky. Who's the person in this movie that's most like the writer of this movie? Oh, it's the writer in the movie, you know? And it's just so pointed, and it's just so dark, and it's like, and given the fact that he directed The Fountain starring his then wife Rachel Weisz, and they got divorced, like, this movie is about each time Javier Bardem creates something, he then has to destroy everything in his life. And now Darren Aronofsky's dating Jennifer Lawrence. Like, it's just this layer and layer of just absolute darkness mixing film with real life. Like, he has to destroy his own life with Jennifer Lawrence to make his next movie or something. And it's just, I don't know, it's this very, it crosses over so much between real life and film. And it's so dark. And this is a movie where a baby is cannibalized. And like, I'm thinking about maybe that reading Darren Aronofsky, of my reading of Darren Aronofsky's movie, and how I think he might view himself is just somehow even darker than that, than the baby being cannibalized to me. You know, it's just, I don't know. It's just weird.
No, I get that 100%. And you look at any movie and yeah, you can do these gross, awful things within this fiction. And you know, if you do it poorly or crassly, then it doesn't really have any emotional impact on you. And then it can easily cross over into camp, like we were saying, or cross over into just simply ineffectual and forgettable. But yeah, I think you're right. And I think if we look at Black Swan and The Wrestler, and I think this might be part of my issue with this movie, as I was saying, like there's this escalation that the mere fact of its escalation is proving something, I think, is maybe a sticking point for me, because it seems like just among those movies, and I think those are really the only ones that fit into this, but I could look everything over and maybe amend this sentence, but there's this direct relationship between the value of the piece of art being made and the personal harm done to the creator in the process of making it.
Yeah.
That I think is perverse, unhealthy, untrue. I think that's what it is, that like the all art is useless without sacrifice. And I don't know, maybe I'm taking a optimistic view of art, but I don't, you know, maybe that's not the way that I want it to be, or not the way that I truly believe it is, or both. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Like you mentioned, one of the questions you might want to talk about is like, how does this make his relationship with Jennifer Lawrence look, or something along those lines. And I just thought, like, if things go bad between them, I think he just points to this movie and said, like, look, I was straight up about this. Like, I destroy everything. And not only do I destroy it in the process, like, that is the process for me, is to... I'm projecting. I'm saying a lot of things that
this whole podcast is us projecting on other people. Like, I mean, this whole podcast, I mean, literally every episode of this podcast is us projecting on other people.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just never been more clear that, like, he's just so aware of it in this one. Like, I think that, as I said, it's in like Black Swan and it's in The Wrestler.
It's in The Fountain a little bit. You just got to squint a little. But anyway, continue.
Right. This one is just so seemingly self-aware that to be creative is to be destructive. Like to make something of value is to destroy everything you have with the people in your life at the time of making it.
Yeah.
And yeah, as you said, like there is awful stuff that happens in this movie, but to look at it from one step back and say that this is what he's saying about, well, this is what we're saying he's saying about himself, is this different kind of darkness.
Yeah. Yep. So, Mother is darkness on darkness on darkness. Enjoy the show, everybody.